Welcome to episode 11 of the Frontal Harvest Podcast.
A podcast about science, technology, and education, and measles.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick.
And together...
Wait, that's mine. And together we are the hosts of the Frontal Harvest Podcast. Maybe not.
I know.
Go ahead and start the administrative stuff.
I'll see if realized, you realize. Yeah, the name.
The name. So we're thinking of changing the name.
I realized that once we got started.
Should we do that at the last of the administrative stuff? No, we might as well start talking about it now.
I think we should. We actually should have started with a new name.
We should have.
How about we just do it with a new name?
Welcome to episode 11.
Yeah. And we're going to call it...
No. We're taping. This is all in.
Okay.
Go ahead. Welcome to...
Welcome to episode 11 of the...
What is it? You want me to say it?
Yeah.
Island Creative Time Podcast.
Which is pretty awesome since Bear Island's coming up.
I know.
Okay.
So we should have a bit of history.
We should.
I don't know why we decided. Was it me mostly that decided that Frontal Harvest really didn't... was out of the blue and didn't match anything?
Well, I think we both started to feel that way as we started to think of it going on the net in a more that we had to make a decision about the name.
Anyway, definitely one part of it is you got really excited for the stuff that was being built and we got the Osh Park board back. And that was originally going to be separate, but we're doing so much with the makerspace at school.
Right.
And that... It didn't really have a name, but it had a little icon or logo type thing. It had a crane and a star. And then we thought, well, the podcast originally, that was kind of your idea when we were at Bear Island last year.
Well, the blog was my idea.
It was the blog.
It was specifically the blog. I thought if we could just take a moment and write down our thoughts and talk about it. And then you got really excited about the podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
The audio, because you listen to them so much at work.
Oh, yeah.
So then it kind of morphed into the podcast. But for dates, Pat and I go out and we discuss things that we've read about and talk about. We have a lot of fun just saying, oh, and I found this and this. And so the podcast kind of gives us that date time.
I have to interject here. Anyone who's out there and has to do a lot of cell culture work, I feel for you. If I didn't have music and podcasts to listen to pass the time when I'm just feeding culture after culture after culture, I'd go crazy. But anyway, you came up with the idea for the name, Island Creative Time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. And it went along with the little icon that you use on the Osh Park boards.
So we're combining our building stuff and our podcasting and blogging into one kind of organization to rule the world.
Exactly.
Well, that was a long administrative stuff.
It was. So we're recording on June 6th, Saturday. I got a little overwhelmed through the week, so I had to postpone to Saturday. The podcast will probably be up on Sunday.
In theory.
And my last blog is not yet up, but it will be up soon.
But I have it in my hands.
He has it in his hands, finally. We've been having a lot of issues with the audio and the new headsets and trying to think of a way that we're providing good sound.
Yeah.
And we're trying yet again another system.
Yeah. So we're still using the headsets. I definitely like them better.
Oh, yeah.
Because we can turn. But last time, it was so easy to get clean audio, and we thought, this is going to be the best.
Right.
But the channels were going in together, and when I listened to it afterwards... It was a nightmare because the audio levels were not carefully matched.
Yeah. And we found also by being able to turn and talk with each other, it was much more back and forth conversation instead of someone staring at a computer screen.
And more fun.
It was more fun for us because we were actually having a conversation and not speaking to the wall.
And we used to turn all the time.
Yeah.
And then go, oh, no. And turn back because you couldn't, right? You'd screw up the audio. So
hopefully you're hearing a little better emotion on our part about the topics and not just kind of a robotic going through. So we'll start with the blog entry. So would you like to start with yours, Pat?
Yeah. Okay, so the last blog entry for me was number 21. And I did it about four experiments. So this is the continuing theme of us trying to get the equipment ready for doing ARDF with the kids at school. Mm-hmm. And there's also a thing in Colorado late in the summer. And it's four experiments. Basically, the problem is we have an extremely low power transmitter right now, and we're planning on building some higher power ones, but this is going to be good for around the school, and we'd like to have a good antenna set up. But at the same time, the antenna has to be quick to set up, and it can't take up too much space. So we're doing experiments to see with our particular transmitter just what can we get away with. Mm-hmm. And two of them were done in the near field, meaning close to the antenna, simply because it was easy. And let me see. I have it up on the blog, but I also wrote down a summary somewhere here. So let's see. Oh, I'm looking for it. Here we go. Yeah. So the first two were done in the living room. And the first one, I had a large solenoid, and I basically was seeing how much of an effect I'd get by loading up the base of the antenna. And that had a huge effect. So that I thought that was surprising. And then I changed the antenna length, and that had less of an effect, but it had definitely a measurable effect. And we're using the Audacity system to measure the output. So that was kind of cool. And then we took it outside. And I guess, what did we do? We measured... We went to the larger antenna, so that was 6 meters.
Right.
And we just, you were driving.
Right.
And helping to set up the antenna, of course. Uh-huh. And we went on old NC86.
Right. So we have this huge thing, this huge PVC antenna. So it's like made out of plumbing supplies.
Yep.
And it goes, I think it's well over
six meters.
Is it 6 meters? Okay. Yep. I thought you were saying 6 feet. That's why I was like,
did
I?
That was a mistake if I did. Six meters, yeah.
Yeah. So it's 6 meters. Sign it up in an open space.
Yep. And there was no solenoid there.
No.
I'm that's definitely for certain. Anyway, and we could hear it 550 meters away.
Right, right.
At the furthest.
About a half kilometer.
Which is okay for around the school.
Yes, yeah.
A little bit short for in the woods behind the school, mm-hmm. but definitely, it's just a different kind of outing, that's
right,
all.
Right.
And then in the fourth experiment, you were really busy, and it was the weekend.
Yeah.
And so I just hopped in the car. No, I didn't.
No, you didn't hop in the car.
No,
that's
I did.
Why.
No, I did.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I hopped in the car and I tried several things, but I tried the toroid thinking, okay, so the solenoid worked really well, right? Mm-hmm. In the near field, but we don't care about that really.
Right, exactly.
So I tried the solenoid with three different positions, a toroid that I just put together, and the antenna without anything special on it. And the solenoid, I could change the inductance to different levels with the taps. So I bracketed the inductances I had with the toroid, which had no taps. And then I also used the maximum inductance, or close to it, to compare to the other. So first of all, we can just skip the toroid, because the really interesting thing is that the solenoid with almost full inductance really didn't have a huge effect. And so that's really interesting, because it had a big effect in the near field, but when we took it outside, it really didn't have a huge effect. So that was number one. Number two, I don't know exactly why, but I was not hearing it as far. And so there's many different things. First of all, this experiment was the first one I didn't do with Audacity. Basically, right. I changed the knob so that the knob on the receiver had little markings.
Mm-hmm.
And I drive away, stop, take a waypoint on the GPS, and then listen for the radio signal, and then start adjusting down the gain until I could not hear it anymore, and then bring it, or not clearly, and then bring it back up. And I always took down as my datum the gain at which I could hear, the minimum gain at which I could hear it clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the data. So there's a few graphs on the blog entry, and there's some fun pictures that you took,
right,
of me setting up the antenna.
But what he didn't mention is part of his later experiments he also did on the recumbent.
Yeah.
In our neighborhood.
Yeah. I had some really strange looks. There were these two women walking with some little kids riding on the bicycles, and they just shooed their kids along. The smaller one on the trike was like, what did he say again? He's like, do you have training wheels? Like, no, I don't have training wheels anymore. And he looks at me. He's like, you're old. And then I don't know if it was his mother or his aunt, was shooing him, come on, come on. He thought I was some real weirdo. And then he just does not want to leave, right? He's checking out the recumbent and slowly moving away. And then he turns around and says, my dad doesn't have training wheels. Anyway, so that was funny. Yeah, so for that one, wait a second. No, the mass isn't 6 meters. The mass is only 3 meters.
Mm-hmm.
It's when I took the recumbent for the first time that I went to 6 meters. And for that, I put together tennis balls and threw it up into a tree.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the difference, which is the system I think we're going to go for.
Mm-hmm.
We might try it out later today, just for a fun outing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the antenna, you know, for 80 meters, it's supposed to be like a quarter of that, so that's 20 meters. There's no way that's happening.
Right, right.
But it looks like 6 meters, we can hear it far enough away that it should be okay for still like 500 meters or so. So that was my blog entry and a little more.
Okay.
Yours was number 22.
Yeah. So, before I start my blog entry.
Oh, what's that?
I'm looking at your head. What is that on your ears? As I said earlier, we can turn and talk to each other, but you also end up seeing some pretty creative inventions.
Yeah, I took last podcast, these earphones just start to hurt my ears in a major way. What are they? Let me see. Turn away from me so I can see the name. They're Rover Beats by Bravo. Anyway, yeah, they were just painful. So I took some ridge rest.
We're campers, so the ridge rest that you lay on.
And I cut out the foam so that it would fit around the ear. Like
Princess Leia.
Yeah.
Princess Leia. So ear protectors.
So they're, yeah. So that's, anyway. Well, I have to say, even though mothers will grab their kids and run away from me if they see me, I am very comfortable.
Okay.
So your blog.
So my blog. So I read this review in Science of using testosterone levels to determine the sex for women athletes, and it was an interesting article.
So wait a second, I just have to say something. But this type of thing is going to happen over and over. And I remember this even being part of the original article, something happening like this. But yeah. Your title, Using Testosterone Level to Determine the Sex of a Woman Athlete.
Yeah.
By definition.
I know.
She's already a woman athlete. I mean, yeah. It's kind of
anyway.
Funny.
Well, like, what am I supposed to say? I'm like. At some point, you have to.
Because they're not determining the sex of the athlete.
No.
They're not saying you're a man versus you're a woman.
Right.
They're saying you're a woman, therefore, let's see if you're a woman.
Woman. I know. I was challenged. But anyway.
So go ahead.
So the article is really good.
Where was it? That was in Science.
It was in Science. Yeah. It was... it was just a brief overview of what's going on. And right now, the International Association of Athletes Federation and the International Olympic Committee are using as one of their indicators for sex, for determining the sex of an athlete, testosterone levels. And the article brings out the conflict with two different studies that give very different results. So we have this study done in 2000 where they found that 13.7% of elite women athletes were above the typical female T levels. And 4.7% were within the typical male range. And these are not T levels that are artificial. These are natural T levels of these elite women athletes. And in the second study, much later, 11 years later in 2011, they got very different results where it showed only 1.5% of women athletes had T levels above the female reference range, and the variation in those data was due to the way that they analyzed the two sets of data. One study used immunoassays; the other study used spectrometer, and they got
mass spec.
Sorry, mass spec, and they got very different results that. Really, you can't compare. It's like apples and oranges.
Well, I mean, I'm under the impression that the biggest variation has more to do with when they're collecting their samples.
Exactly.
And relative to exercise.
Yeah.
And what's the other thing? I mean, mass spec is more accurate.
Right. So
that's not the issue, I don't
think.
You're
right. No, you really hit it on the nail. It's really... when they collect their samples and how close to the event that they collect the samples, like if they had just done that exercise and for the length of time right. they've done the exercise, even, external input from coaches and that can change the levels. So this is something that really varies depending on many factors.
Before we move off.
Yeah.
This topic about like why are these studies showing something different? I just looked. I can't find the article right now. So I'm going by memory, but I faintly remember that one of the groups was deciding ahead of time what they would consider as a true woman athlete versus not, right?
Right.
So
right.
didn't they exclude a bunch of women?
Yes.
Am I wrong about that?
They did. And one of them was Dadi Shan, who's an Indian sprinter. And
so,
she's actually challenging this whole system of using testosterone as one of the indicators of whether they're within the female parameters.
Yeah.
And that's really what's starting this whole debate is this athlete challenging this whole testing. And I think it really does need to be challenged, because I think with just, you know, a little thought and into, you know, looking at the factors that impact testosterone levels and thinking about when they're collecting the data and having more data about those different levels at different times, for the athletes would give them some interesting information to look at. Right now they don't have all the information they need to really make a substantial, you know, comment about a woman's.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused still as to whether there is significant overlap between men and women.
Yeah.
In testosterone levels. I mean, definitely the original idea was that there wasn't.
Yeah.
And that's being called into question.
Right.
I'm not certain. I mean, yeah. And definitely this is fascinating, because I had no idea how complicated an issue this was.
I guess that's what attracted me to this particular article.
I mean,
it's
in everyday
one that
life.
I think we'll see more information about, especially as the summer comes into full swing. And we have some of these events going on. But, wow, with just a bit of funding for some good research, they could really have some wonderful data to look at.
I'd even say it's really sad how these policies are put forward with just so little evidence one way or the other, when they're taking in so much money.
Right. They're taking in a lot of money, and they aren't even using like some great science that I think that with very little effort they could get a number of researchers at their door.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's my article.
So that's your blog entry.
That's my blog entry.
Your article.
Yep.
Okay. Let me find our notes again. Oh, minor topics. Mm-hmm. Do you mind?
Sure. Since sure. Start stuff. With you and
let
I'll
me go to the top of the list.
I'll dig in.
So
I have a few cool ones.
So we put in an order to Amadon for some toroids because of the work on the, and I think we might still go back to the toroids. I think the getting the inductance right in the right places will help, but later. Anyway, so we got some material number 2 and material number 26, iron powder toroids. Mm-hmm. I think the number 2 are the only one we can really use because of its properties. But we got several sizes to experiment with, and two of them, the packaging on the labeling on the packaging was switched, and one of the 2s was labeled as 26, and one of the 26 was labeled as the 2. You remember that? The orange?
That's right. I remember you
yellow
telling
and
me.
The yellow material 2 is yellow. Yellow. No. No, it's red. It's red. Mm-hmm. And 26 is yellow, I think. Anyway, so, I should have written back. I should have emailed them. Because, I mean, so I noticed the difference, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, fine. Switch them. But if it had been ferrite, they're all the same color.
Right.
That could have been a world of just
craziness
trying to figure out what the hell is going wrong. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, that's one thing. Minor things. Well, we'll save Loki and Opa until last. We'll do that together at the end of your minor ones. But we just ran out of time.
We did.
So we wanted to make a big deal out of those two, and we'll just keep them as minor. Let's see, experiment on the recumbent I talked about. Let's see. Oh, so I did a lot more work on GNU plot. Mm-hmm. Did some plot, used it at work to plot some graphs and stuff. Not really at home, although I'm going to use it here also. No, that's not true.
Yeah.
I did use it at home.
Yeah.
So it's really turning out to be a good system. I'm really liking it.
Nice.
Like all these types of system, it takes a bit, a bit of time to get going.
Right.
But then I have a few scripts, and now they're like templates, and I just want to make a graph, and I copy the template over and do it. So where it came out, where it could do something that was really fancy, was Our, we think it was our modem for our home network was dropping off the network, and our son Luke just figured this
was
happening.
Because it was breaking up his game time.
I know. That's terrible. But anyway, so I wrote a script to see if it was really happening, and the script was just pinging Google once a minute.
Right.
And then I had some other scripts going to turn that data, so it was logging it to a file, and to turn that data into a graph using GNUplot.
Right.
And all you had to do, rearrange my recording, all you had to do was hit update and then reload your web page that was showing what the graph was, mm-hmm. and it was constantly remaking the plot.
Right.
So that was really cool.
So imagine how you would feel as a technician coming to a home to check their modem. This is the second time, and you don't know if the people are kind of crazy or what. And you come in and you have a geek fest where you have people that have graphed for the last 24 hours every outage yeah. that your modem has had. I was laughing to myself at school thinking, I wonder if you'll get the full data analysis or not.
The house is pretty messy right now, and
oh, it's
when
a
the
mess.
Guy showed up,
yeah,
he switched out our modem basically.
Yeah.
But when the guy showed up, I thought, oh, it's such a mess. And then I thought, well, okay, so whatever. It wasn't that he came in, and the mast for the antenna experiments was in the living room.
Yeah,
we were trying to talk to him, Luke and I. Just kind of kept staring at the mask, like, what is this? Don't think he noticed how messy it was.
He was
anyway.
Too focused.
Yeah.
It's a bird holder. I have something to mention. You know, you said that you just needed a little library of a few scripts so you could do many things with that program.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought you should really just... post your library on our blog. You know, here's something I started, and then post your library. So if someone starts, they have this whole, you know, easy setup to work with.
Yeah, that might be a good way to do it.
Yeah, like me.
Put it on a... Oh, okay.
There's no way I'm going to start from scratch. But
yeah, yeah.
If I had like all the pointers to start with.
Especially templates.
Yeah, templates are good.
Because then you can run it, see if it works.
Right, right.
And then once you see a graph, then you can go in the file and be like, oh, that's the data.
Right.
And then you can just change the numbers.
Right.
And then it's suddenly your graph. And anyway. So let's see. Next thing.
Do you want to do one of mine?
Well, I still have
okay.
a lot of the minor ones.
Okay.
The Raspberry Pis, we had some problem with the same type of thing happening before the modem.
Right, right.
Where, that's a different problem.
I think so.
We have one of those USB Wi-Fi little things you have in the Pi
right.
in the living room. And it kept dropping off, so I had the script that just kept pinging him to keep him alive, and man, that goes down fast. It's like I tried it every 15 minutes, every 10 minutes, and it's only when I got to ping it every 5 minutes that he stayed awake. I'm sure there's better ways to do this, but for now, at least he's fast at waking, or not waking up, but fast at responding on our home network. What else? I talked about the antenna experiments.
Mm-hmm.
6 meters was the longest we... Oh, we tested different numbers of radials.
Yeah.
Okay, let's pause this.
Okay.
Don't pause the Audacity.
Okay.
Okay, Luke.
Luke?
Oh, sorry.
We can't pause it, so if you... Do you have something quick?
Do you need money?
Okay.
It broke?
Yeah,
okay.
Okay.
Okay, so we're back.
Yeah.
I'll try to find that.
Okay.
If you help to remind me.
Yeah.
So let's see, what do I have? Oh, so we went climbing. Last Sunday at was it last
three,
Sunday? Two
three
Sundays ago?
climbs.
Three climbs. Yeah, that was cool. So we did place your bet. We tried it twice each. That we almost made it.
We almost did. We actually did a good job, I thought.
Yeah, met some neat guys there.
We
from Winston-Salem, I guess.
Yeah, very nice people.
Yeah. And then we went over to Scarface.
Right.
And so the reason that's kind of interesting is the one of the bolts on the anchor at Scarface was loose. And I emailed the guys at the Carolina Climbers Coalition. And the guy, I'd have offered, you know, to see if we're going to be up there, if I have a wrench, if I should do something about it or just let them do it. And he's like, no, you know, you can go ahead. The big thing is to not over-tighten them and just make it nice and snug. And that if it starts to spin inside the hole there, then they have a different system called gluons. So I'm curious. We used to know a little bit more about this, but we've never actually done anything like this. So that'll be interesting if we end up there tomorrow. Let's see. And that's all I have for my kind of minor things.
Okay. I have some minor things that that I had that I thought were kind of fun. So there's 7 new species of miniature frogs found. So these frogs are the size of a bumblebee. And they're only 13 millimeters long. Isn't that cool?
Where was...
And this, they were found in Brazil.
Brazil.
They're in the mountains. They, you know, they... There's a few things about it. It's just, I don't know.
Is this all from one group, or is this just a recent
This is a recent find, and it was in one area, if I understand. So it's this remote area, and it's like, it just goes to show you how we still, we know so little about some very isolated systems, ecosystems.
Yeah, no kidding, because these are vertebrates.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd figure we're starting to know everything that's out there, but...
Yeah, and some of the cool features, so the frog is much smaller, so it doesn't have all the fingers that the larger frogs have.
That
has fewer fingers. And so, and I guess this is research that's been done for the last 5 years. And it is by Marcio Pai, a professor at the Universidad Federal do
Paraná.
Paraná. Great. So I thought it was pretty cool. It gets into sky islands. I love it.
I know, yeah.
You know, when I heard the, you know, when I was just skimming it very quickly.
Well, because of the altitude.
Right. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, I thought it was just because of the forest.
Right.
But they're not just...
So it's kind of cool that there's sky islands, and so we have this kind of unique diversity going on.
Yeah.
Because of the isolation.
Yeah.
So just a interesting find, and wonderful stuff.
Was this out of Science?
This was not out of Science, but it was posted in Science News. It was out of The Guardian.
Okay.
And it was posted under the Science News section.
Gotcha.
So the other thing that I actually wanted to do a few weeks ago now, it was on the olive trees in Italy and how they have a bacterium that is infecting them. And it causes a disease, and this disease is caused by invasive plants. So plants brought over from Costa Rica, they think, that have this particular disease, and they spread it to the olive plants. It comes from ornamental coffee plants and oleander. So it's just one of those things that we just don't know what we're carrying home sometimes. Or
I have it up.
You do. And so I just found it interesting. It is just one of those topics that when I hit, there's a lot of concern of it spreading further and further north, and they're trying to stop that by taking down diseased trees and things. But if you think about the age of the olive groves and that, it's just...
It looks like it's that narrow, in that narrow peninsula, the heel of the Italian boot, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it's moving up.
Yeah, so very, very sad. I hope they control it just because, I don't know, you think of the history in an olive tree and it's just...
It reminds you a little bit of, I'm thinking, was it phlox? They don't talk about it. Let me see. Xylella fastidiosa.
Right.
It reminds me a bit of, I was about to say, of phylloxera. Was that the one that, that was a fungus that killed grapes in Europe, I guess. Yep. So, is that the one they were talking about here?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know if I just read the name.
Yeah. So, and its primary vector is the spittle bug. So, anyway, that was one that I was wanting to share a little bit ago. The other one that I came across, and so did you, it's this Terra Ocean study of plankton.
Yeah.
And so they're using a schooner to get a planet-wide, or to do a planet-wide survey of plankton, and hopefully to improve our understanding about the plankton life in our oceans.
That was a story in Science.
That
also.
Was a story in Science. So
Terra is the schooner.
Yep.
Terra Oceans is the consortium.
Right.
Oh, I don't see... I saw somewhere a map of where they'd traveled all the way around the world.
Yeah.
That whole issue of Science was neat. Lots of ocean-type stuff.
Yeah. And it was a lot of the plankton.
Yeah.
A focus on plankton or the diatoms. I thought it was interesting, and... I'm interested to see where it goes from here.
And this is really basically a diversity mission, like figuring out the diversity of plankton in the oceans. I see they're using ribosomal RNA.
Right.
So I assume they're not actually isolating plankton. They're just looking for the RNA, is it? RNA, yeah, that they're finding.
Yeah. So... A neat little venture that's going on. The other things that I had. So, okay. So also and you've read more about this than I have, but the MERS outbreak in Korea. So that's different and kind of unexpected.
Yeah, well, I don't remember a ton about it, but basically I think it's been transmitted mostly in the hospitals, if maybe possibly starting in one hospital because of a
poor ventilation is what they're saying that is responsible for the spread in the hospitals.
Yeah, well, also, so I think at least there might be a single person that they know came over infected from the Middle East.
Right.
And then I think one of the issues with the hospital, of course, is that you've got a lot of sick people.
Right.
So if they get exposed to, they don't need as much of a dose to get MERS.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, many of the things you do in a hospital cause aerosolization.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Yeah.
You tend to make the virus more easily transmittable.
Right. So that's, you know, hopefully that gets under control in the next little while. An earlier article said they would be surprised if that would go to, like, you know, extreme pandemic kind of scenario.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's...
No.
It's the type of thing that travels easily.
Mm-hmm.
It's I mean, boy. Yeah. It's been a while since I looked at the whole camel thing. But it looks like it's really strongly associated with transmission directly from camels rather than person to person in the Middle East.
Yeah, and one of the points that I read about it in the article is that it might be actually easier for them to vaccinate camels than it would be for them to worry about, like, to control transmission that way than to try to work the virus the other. So I thought that was a interesting way of looking at it. Okay. My last one, which actually it's in another section, so I will wait.
Your last one is in another section?
Yeah, so I have topics of interest, so but I put it into topics of interest and I should put it into mention. Sorry.
So we're gonna do the two other minor topics, I guess, now?
Yep.
So we were gonna do these as major ones, but we haven't had time to review them. I guess one is OPA. I'll say that one. Mm-hmm. I'll start with that one because the other one was really your find. We got really interested in this article about the fish OPA. It's in the deep oceans. I don't remember exactly the term they use for it. But they had something pelagic, semi-pelagic or something. Mesopelagic fish. Anyway, what's neat about it is that, and we think of fish as being pretty much cold-blooded. And it turns out that there's a lot of fish that are endotherms partially. So they're able to maintain part of their, just some organs, higher temperature, maybe some muscles or some, or the brain in some fish. Mm-hmm. The typical example of that is the tuna. Mm-hmm. And of course you need a pretty big fish for this to be the case.
Right.
And OPA is the first time that a fish has been found where the entire body basically is kept above ambient temperature.
Right.
And it allows it to dive deep longer than tuna can. And it's more active and so on and so forth. And it's one of those typical current mechanisms that allows this to happen. Fish are in the water, so the rate of heat transfer from the body to the external environment is very quick, which makes it difficult. Plus, on top of that, unlike the mammals in the ocean, they're exchanging oxygen through their gills, which have to come in contact with water, which will transfer heat very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And mammals, of course, through blowholes in their top of their head or snouts for like things like manatees. The oxygen exchange happens through air, which has a much slower conductance of heat. So you have big muscles in large fish. They generate heat that you have to get oxygen to those muscles. And so the blood carrying the oxygen then goes right back away from the muscles, taking that heat with it, goes to the gills, where it's in intimate contact with water, because it has to be in order to get the oxygen out. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a problem, and it's in OPA you have just an extremely advanced countercurrent mechanism, like you find in many animals for heat conservation, but it's just unlike any other fish, the extent to which you have countercurrent. So basically you're talking about your arterial and your venal sides being closely matched so that the blood going to the gill is matched with veins coming back from the gills, and through an extended distance this allows the transfer of heat from the artery to the veins so that the artery is close in temperature to the external environment by the time it gets to the gill. And the article, so let me see, I should come up, it's a research report is it in Nature or Science? It's in Science,
yes,
in issue 6236. I don't see the date. May 15th. And 2015, and they have some fantastic pictures, and you really can see in profile the fish. One of those, a little bit like they show, you know, those heat-sensitive cameras
taking pictures
of the people. You have a hot spot right over the brain, but really the whole body is above normal, except the outer edge where you have the fins, and this kind of squarish section just cut out where the gills are.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
That is.
And then the picture of these countercurrent mechanisms around the gills are absolutely fantastic. They have a special name for them.
So the fish, and I'm sure someone that's really into fish would totally disagree with me, but they look kind of like the hatchet fish that you get in your aquariums,
yeah.
You know, just so you have an idea.
Humongous. I mean, these
fish I mean, they're much larger. I'm just giving you the kind of shape so you can visualize the shape.
Yeah. The Oprah. The Opa. Lampris guttatus. I'm trying to find the place that has this countercurrent mechanism. Here they call them Rhetia mirabilia. No, Rhetia mirabilia. Mirabilia. This means wonderful gnats. Countercurrent heat exchanges.
Yeah, right here. Yeah.
Anyway.
Nice.
So that was one of our things that we're turning into a minor topic.
And that was a cool article.
Yeah.
It's really neat, like, as we're trying to think of articles, it's kind of cool that we have articles that we get really excited about, but we can't share as fully as we wanted to.
Yeah.
So that's always a good problem to have.
I really liked both the temperature profiles, as you see close to the surface, it's hanging around the same temperature as the environment, and then it dives, and the temperature of the water goes down.
Right.
And its temperature drops too, but it's always maintained above.
Right.
And then you look at their graph comparing how long they spend at what depth, you know, what fraction of the day compared to tuna.
Right.
And it's phenomenal. They spend, compared to tuna, I mean, basically tuna spends most of its time closer to the surface.
Right.
In the top 50 meters. And the opa is down there, especially during the day. I mean, I think during the day, well, yeah, there it is on the graph. Only 7% of its time above 50 meters during the day. And even at night, right? Only 31% of its time. I mean, for the tuna, it's 89 and 58% of its time above 50 meters. So getting down where the nutrient-rich waters are and having a easier time finding good quality food.
Yeah, that is really neat. So cool mechanism.
Yep. Rhetia mirabilia. 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 Yeah.
Nice.
So, how about our next
our
topic
next
of
one?
Interest?
Okay. So, our next one. So, I will go over to the Loki, Bridging the Gap. So,
this one showed up in many places.
It did. It did.
It made the front of Wikipedia.
Really?
One time, yeah.
Oh, that's neat. So, I was really excited about it because we happened to be covering oceans and hydrothermal vents at the time.
Yep.
So, you know, and when you say, wow, and it may lead to a better understanding of early life on Earth.
So explain what it is. What's Loki?
So Loki is this neat little single-celled organism. And it's between a prokaryote and...
Well, it is a prokaryote.
It is a prokaryote.
But it's not it's an archaea.
It's an archaea. And it's showing definite connections to eukaryotic cells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's definitely some
structures.
Some genes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we have to go by genes. We don't know by structures.
We can
Yeah.
We're guessing it
we're
has
guessing.
Some structures.
You're right. I always go to structures, yeah. but yeah. you're right. It's not structures. It's the genes.
I mean, basically, these people dug up some mud mm-hmm. from places close to a hydrothermal vent called Loki mm-hmm. Between, I guess, Greenland and Norway?
Yes.
I think. And they analyzed the DNA in there. Mm-hmm. I think it was DNA. Was it RNA?
I think it was RNA.
So, let's see. No? Maybe they did both.
Oh, maybe.
Anyway, and this they found, well, I don't remember. There were three main things, but one is genes that coded for molecules, for proteins that were the closest to eukaryotic actin found mm-hmm. anywhere.
Right.
And already the archaea have some that are closer than bacteria, but this particular actin is much closer.
Mm-hmm.
And let me see, what are you showing? Genetic information processing machineries of archaea, most similar. Well, that's another thing. That's RNA.
Right.
Is that right? It'd be the ribosomes.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, I didn't even remember that.
See, that's why I keep on jumping to structures, but yeah. not...
Well, actin would yeah. be structure of...
Right.
Right, cytoskeleton.
Right.
I mean, we all, for a long time, when we were in college, I think the general party line was bacteria don't have a cytoskeleton.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know... Okay, there's a few proteins that give them some structure, nothing like ours, but this Loki archaeotum definitely has stuff that's very close to what we have mm-hmm. in terms of actin. Takes more than actin to give you as much structure as we
right,
have.
Right, right.
It doesn't have any organelles as far as we know. Right? Mm-hmm. Never been isolated. So.
Yeah, so it's just this exciting new find.
Yep.
And I think now that they've started, I think it's going to start a whole area of research that will really bring up some neat evidence.
And then I think the other thing wasn't there some small GTPases?
Yeah, I was looking.
There were some small GTPases. That was one of the other... proteins whose genes were
yeah,
very
right
similar.
Yeah, right over here, I think.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway.
So.
Yeah.
I think the big issue here is that the original idea was we had bacteria in the beginning. Okay, mm-hmm. so fine, they're prokaryotes. And at some point, you have archaea that branch out, mm-hmm. and you have some bacteria engulfing other bacteria?
Yes.
Or some archaea engulfing bacteria?
Mm-hmm.
And that's eukaryotes.
Right. And that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. And the two lineages happened around, I don't know, about the same time mm-hmm. or not, but basically we had a good idea of the mitochondrion and the chloroplast. Okay, that looks really bacterial-like mm-hmm. in terms of gene sequences and so on. But what is it? What molecule did the engulfing?
Mm-hmm.
And from these genetic sequences they found in Loki Archaeum, then in the Loki Archaeum, which technically is it's like a genome of many different genera of Loki Archaeota.
I mean,
it's like kind of a mixture, right? They don't...
Mm-hmm.
But... according to these genes, no, that's not what happened. You have bacteria that had a branch split off into the archaea,
mm-hmm.
and then these archaea evolved for a while, and then one branch split off and got these fancy new actins and GTPases and something, some other stuff like that, more involved in giving better structure to the cell.
Right.
And then one of those engulfed the bacterium.
Mm-hmm.
and that was the mitochondria, and it, mm-hmm. it of the in or would become the mitochondria in the future. And so that one that engulfed the mitochondrion and engulfed the chloroplast became the eukaryotic cell millennia later.
Mm-hmm.
And that original archaeum that did the, or archaeota that did the engulfing became also Loki
right.
archaeota. That's
right.
the one from before the engulfing. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like we came from archaeota.
Which is
very cool.
It is just so cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So neat. Very good stuff.
Yep.
And I think definitely an area we're going to hear more about.
Yeah, I hope we do.
In the future. Yeah.
So, I like all of these types of things that kind of test the limits of what you believe and basic understandings of what's out there. You know, this is definitely...
Right.
We had no idea something could be this close to eukaryotes and mm-hmm. it readjusts the tree.
Right, right. I think that's really neat.
We still haven't talked about measles.
We
so
haven't.
I guess that's the,
I think that's our next yeah. one. And
so we don't have a ton... Oops, I'm in Loki still. We don't have actually a ton of... like, Opa had all these news stories about it. The measles didn't. By the way, the Loki, the main article, the original report, that, you know, the original research, that was in Nature.
Oh, okay, yes, yeah. you're right. That was in Nature.
But it showed up in Science, and it showed mm-hmm. up on the Wikipedia page and
yeah.
In some other places.
Very exciting stuff.
So, you know, I think we're actually going to only talk about measles a much... We talked more than I thought we would about both Loki and Opa.
Yeah, unintentional.
So,
but yes, we are going to get to it no matter what.
So, well, the thing is, I don't have as much to talk about.
No.
So the measles story is really important, I think.
It is.
So that's why it's a major topic. But I don't think we're going to have as much as...
We won't.
...as putting together Loki and Opa. Anyway, did you
want
to...
Sure. Do you want me to start?
Yeah.
So the measles vaccine has been around for about 50 years. And, you know, we've been doing these massive vaccination campaigns to get as many children vaccinated before school as possible to limit contamination or... I should say transmission of the measles virus. And recently, when they started looking into the measles and how it really impacts a body when someone breaks down with measles, is that they found out that if a child is infected, the strange thing about measles is that it wipes out their prior immunity. So they will get immunity to the measles virus, of course, after having that, you know, the measles outbreak, but they lose their prior immune history. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, I think, okay. I mean, we know from lab studies, if I remember correctly, that it preferentially infects memory B lymphocytes.
Right.
Maybe T lymphocytes also. I'm not certain, but so basically, it destroys them.
Right.
And so if you get exposed to, I don't know, polio, and you make it through, and you have all these B memory lymphocytes, then you're immune to polio from that point on because the second you get exposed again, then they're ready to go, and your response is very quick and very strong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those memory cells that hang on for years after your initial exposure, if you get measles, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are, anyway.
Right.
And the wild thing that's really scary to think about is if a kid gets measles, that means all of those vaccines he had before that time, there's a good chance a lot of them are either no longer, he's no longer immune from his vaccinations, or much has much reduced immunity.
Wow. Yeah. So for me, the article is really important, not just because of the information that it had, but it just reinforced how important those vaccines are to get, especially measles. But
let me reference this. Okay. So it was in Science.
Mm-hmm.
Issue 6235. When is that?
So that's May 8th.
May 8th. Okay.
2015.
Okay. And it looks like the group is from Princeton, New Jersey, Princeton University.
Mm-hmm.
I mean. And where else? Emory, in Atlanta. Fogarty International Center, National Institutes of Health. Erasmus University Medical Center in Rotterdam.
Mm-hmm.
So those must be. So they basically looked at epidemiological data from three places. Rotterdam group must be giving the data from Denmark, because that was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The other two are United States is one, and England and Wales
mm-hmm.
is the third one. So.
The other thing is, we just had a recent outbreak of measles. Did you know that?
Where?
At Disney World in California.
Huh. I know. Yeah.
So I think it happened less than a year, I think.
Yeah.
And there was a big outbreak of it, and they put it back to the Disneyland experience.
Yeah, the typical many people coming from different.
Yeah.
But the thing is, in the U.S., people are mostly vaccinated, aren't they?
Well, I think most people are. I think it's unfortunate, but there's misinformation about vaccines and the connection with autism.
Uh-huh.
And so some people choose not to have their child vaccinated because of autism, even though that data was totally.
Yeah, I remember that was proven to be
fraudulent,
incorrect.
You know.
Well, yeah. I don't know if it was.
Well, I guess that might be too harsh, but his data was flawed.
Anyway, I mean, to go into specifics about what they did is there was this question before they looked at this data. First of all, epidemiological data is very noisy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you can't just look at it or do an experiment, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess there was this problem that if you looked at what happened when measles vaccines were introduced, the death rate dropped significantly.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't drop. It dropped more than you should expect from the decreased deaths to measles. And because it's noisy, it was hard to make a connection. And if so, I'm going to go by memory now, but the way I understand it is they looked at, okay, how many people are dying from non-measles diseases, right? Because mm-hmm. if you're destroying the immune cells, then you should have more people dying, right? Now, if you look out long enough, the people that have survived will have regained their immunity.
Right.
Right? So they looked at measles cases reported in these three different places, United States, England and Wales, and then Denmark. And they said, okay, how many people died from non-measles deaths in the following, I'm going to make up a number, mm-hmm. 6 months after?
Right.
The introduction of the vaccine. And, or maybe it's after they had measles. No, that can't be right. Because that wouldn't be in the data reported. It's not per person.
Right.
It's as a population. Yeah, so that's why it's so noisy.
Right.
So, introduce vaccine. How many people reported to die of non-measles cases in the following 6 months, and how many in the following 12 months after the introduction, and what if you go all the way out to a year and a half, and so on. And they kept extending that, and for every one of these tests, they looked back and see, you know, well, how does that correlate with the number of measles cases you had? And, I can't remember, was it 28 months was the critical point? So at 28 months, you had the best correlation. And what's, you look at the data, and man, I mean, we haven't had time to look at it in depth, right? But it just seems very noisy. But what's really fantastic is it's the same time in all three countries with different histories and different types of populations. And oh, there you have it.
Yeah, I just found it.
28.3 months. I was looking for that all over.
I know.
Where is that? Page 696, column 3?
Yes, that's correct.
696, column 3. Yeah, there it is. No. I'm on the wrong page here. Yeah. Yeah, centered. 28 months. So that's pretty amazing that every all three. And basically it says, so what's 28? It's 2.5 years? About?
Yeah.
So it looks like it takes 2.5 years for this what did they call it? Measles shadow to move through the population. And it really says, wow, measles vaccination is extremely important.
Yes.
Not only that, but the whole population. So what do they call that when you don't look at a person's immunity?
Oh, the herd.
Herd immunity, exactly. The herd immunity after measles vaccination really goes up.
It does.
Because all these dangerous other diseases now, their rates are reduced,
Because of immunity built there was up over time.
There was an interesting, one of the things that was a bit confusing to researchers in the past is that there's no sign that after the initial immunity comes back that you've had such bad damage to your immune system from being infected with the vaccine because, your peripheral lymphocytes come back. I think this was a DeVry study, wasn't it? He did it in macaques, actually. Yeah, there it is. DeVries et al. Suppression, immune suppression in macaques. Yeah, they basically, I mean, this is known in humans, but they looked at it carefully in macaques, and they found that a lot of the B and T cells come back within a shortened time period. Definitely not this 28 months, of course.
Right.
And, you know, they hypothesized that these are probably all B lymphocytes, and I don't know if it was T that they looked at, but that are actually the response to the measles virus.
Right.
So you see the immunity come back, but really it's not. You're just seeing all these immune cells that are there to defend you against measles. Okay, so you're fine there. But all the others that you lost haven't come back. They've been replaced by these redundant ones.
This one's pretty incredible.
So, what's that? Approximately 50% of all childhood deaths recorded over 5 years of follow-up occurred. I know.
2 months after the measles infection.
Yeah, so what is it? So it's 50% of all childhood deaths recorded over 5 years follow-up occurred within only 2 months of measles infection. Yeah, and I mean, so these are precluding detection of long-term sequelae in those children. But is that...
So this is...
Is it due to secondary... Because the way I understand it is... Measles A lot of people say it's not that dangerous, but it really is.
Right.
And a lot of the measles deaths come from secondary infections. But that's during your, you know, while the child has measles, or the adult. That doesn't even include this immune suppression that happens for years and years afterwards.
Right.
Or not immune, I don't know, it's like immune ablation.
Yeah.
That carries yeah. on for years and years because it's gone. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So, yeah.
It's funny. In a way, it's really sad that there's this happening. In another way, it's really just incredibly awesome that we have so much power to reduce disease by just this one vaccine.
Right, right.
Yep. Well, I
guess...
Definitely
an important topic.
Yeah. Makes me want to look at the... Well, I don't know. Epidemiological data, when it's complicated like this, it's heavy going through it.
Yeah.
So...
Very interesting.
I might go back to it.
Mm-hmm. So, what are your future plans?
So, we're all done here. Let me check one last thing. Yes! I knew there was something I wanted to ask you. This
sorry.
Is for you. You were so excited when you came back late last night, but you were so excited. Or was it this morning? You didn't tell me until this morning about your EOG results.
Oh, so we were very excited because we got good EOG results. So that means that we can choose what we want to do in our class instead of someone choosing for us. But yeah. No, when we got really good results.
I have to say, when I was asked, I mean, I was really fascinated by this because, mm-hmm. so I want to clear things because you're in the middle of this, so you totally
right.
understand all of this. But what was really the big statistical, or it's not statistical, but the big change that was noticeable is this increase in 4 percentage points.
Right.
For the number of kids in your science classes, or in the science EOGs.
Yeah, the entire eighth grade. So
that
this
pass.
Just isn't my class. Yeah. Yep.
That pass.
Yeah, that pass. So we had 90% yeah. pass rate, and we were right. very excited
right.
about
right.
it.
So this says nothing about the effect on the kids that are doing better.
No.
But on the kids that have the hardest time, they're doing a lot better.
Right. Yeah, yeah. We're starting to pick up our yeah. kids that are struggling, which
yeah.
is just... exciting
yeah.
you know
yeah.
and we've been and we've always worked at it, but we're starting to get something that works a little better.
Do any of yeah I mean talking to you I don't want to go into this
yeah.
in depth unless you want to, but it seemed like you really were confident that it had to do with some changes you made. And I mean, personally
yeah.
when I look at it, I'm thinking, what was it, like probably 86 to 90%.
Right.
86.
And these are unofficial scores, I should say.
Right, right.
So this
right.
is not...
But from yeah. my point of view, if you're getting 86% to pass, right,
mm-hmm.
so that's a certain level, and you have a certain population to work with, and that's what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what you're doing and stuff, and I think it's phenomenal. When I hear 90, I'm like, yeah, yeah.
Well...
But you're already... Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
For you, if you're just working really hard
mm-hmm.
and you're staying at 96 and then suddenly you get to 90,
it's
I can see yeah. like it's a huge difference.
Right. So we've done several things different this
yeah.
year. And one of the things that we've really made a point of is having the kids really write about what their understanding is. Because... And it's not like we're having them write paper after paper. They're writing just a really solid paragraph, and we call it the meal. We use the AVID approach to do this. And if you go online, you can check meal and writing a paragraph. And
M-E-A-L. Uh-huh.
And it stands for main idea, evidence, analysis, and link.
I mean, from the way you were describing it, I got the impression that it's not enough that they write a paragraph, you really direct them and redirect
right.
them if they're not doing it the way you want.
Right. So we just really
uh-huh.
direct them in writing this meal. Like, okay, so what, first, what is your answer to this question? Is it, yes, I agree, or yes, I, or this is true because, you know, but they have to, like, I'm trying to think of a question that we've used so I could use it, but one of them, you know, does Bowling Creek have good water quality? Well, we do our water testing at Bowling Creek, but their paragraph about Bowling Creek water quality would be, yes, it's good because, and then they could use any of the tests that we go out and collect the data, we go out and collect at the stream. So yes, it has great dissolved oxygen, it has great pH levels, right. It has great turbidity, the macroinvertebrates. So they have all of this data to support what they're saying. So they can't just say good, bad, move on. And so I think by making them really think about the evidence and getting them to collect that evidence in some form so that they're using it in that paragraph and connecting it to their understanding of good and bad water quality suddenly makes it a very strong statement right. that they can make. And we later, at the end of the water unit, we go into Warren County, which had the contaminated water because of the toxic landfill that was put in without a liner. Well, everything makes sense. Oh, those toxins are coming from that, you know, that landfill that didn't have the liner that's leaching down into their aquifer, and the aquifer is getting those higher PCB levels because of the PCBs that they put right. in the surface. Well, there's a connection there.
Although this
there.
Is not technically an aquifer, is it?
No, a water table.
The water
I guess
table.
Water
right.
table is probably better. But anyway, it's like that direct connection. It's right. not just, oh, that's a bad landfill because it doesn't have
yeah,
this,
yeah.
move on. It's like, and this
oh my
is
gosh,
connected
it's,
to this.
Yeah.
And it sounds simple and sometimes ridiculous, but I think when you're dealing with people who are really developing a maturity about evidence to support claims, it's really necessary, and I think it's part of them growing into educated citizens.
Two questions.
Mm-hmm.
First, a real simple. What's AVID?
AVID is I might have forgotten the whole acronym.
No, but what's
basically
the point of it?
It's to promote student achievement, and it's to work with students who are kids that are going to college, but or have an opportunity to go to college, but they need supports to help them get college bound ready.
Okay.
I could have used AVID when I was in school.
Okay.
And it's initially the targeted families would be the families who do not have a college graduate at
is
home.
Is this a funded program that
it
you
is
guys...
a funded program. It's a program
is
that's
this
run
state or federal?
Federal.
Federal.
And it is it's a great program when it's run well, like every program.
And then the other more interesting question, do you have any sense these kids, I mean presumably you have an idea of which kids are those that were bumped slightly, which you could have lost but which you did different?
Yeah, I have one. I have like two that yeah. I'm very pleased with.
Do they have any connection with the maker spaces or the
they did both
they
of them.
Did interesting.
I was so excited. I looked, I'm like both of them came, and they came at the first
I
mean, year
I'd
but
be
not at the end
yeah,
but I was
perfect,
just like woohoo.
I'd be perfectly fine yeah. if the maker space didn't hit those kids and
yeah.
no I want to know yeah. what's really happening
yeah
but
no
that's
I
cool
do too
that it did.
But two of them that were borderline oh
yeah.
no three I'm starting to remember now there's three there's two girls and one boy that
wow.
were, yeah, so those three were all my ones that when they started the year, I knew that, oh no, four. Wow, it's growing, four. Four that were all on the border. That I will say those four students only came for the first 2 months,
yeah.
and then it became too, well, they had social obligations.
Yeah.
but
that
I,
makes me really excited for the makerspace.
Doesn't it? And
yeah.
and now I'm like, okay, I really do have to move it and make sure that it happens in
yeah.
September, which we did, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it, you know, this year I don't have to run around trying to get equipment.
Yeah. Just want to say a little thing I totally didn't mention, but one of the big things I got interested in is, well, I did mention NEC, did I?
No, you did not.
Oh my gosh. I totally skipped numerical electromagnetics code. So, I guess I'll put it in now.
Okay, yeah. Should,
I mean, we're interested in the antenna stuff, and for years I've wanted to do a little bit of work with antenna modeling stuff. I mean, I like the physics, right? And it's just, I found for me there was a big barrier to getting into it because of understanding how it works. But last night, for the first time, I finally got a model going, and I used a program called XNEC2C, which is, so NEC, or I don't know if people call it NEC or not, was written in the 1970s, I think, in Fortran, and it's basically used to model antennas. There's open source version. The latest or the most advanced, I think, of the open source is NEC2. There's also an NEC4 that you need for which you need a license. And I was using a package that controls this, and I was actually, you know, you make these little text files. You probably don't have to with all software, but you make these little text files that looks like cards you put into computers, or you used to in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. You've done some of that.
Oh,
right?
I
never have.
Yeah.
But, and last night I was up so late, finally. It was just so exciting, and that's why I can't even remember if the EOG results were something you talked about last night when you came late, or if it was this morning. But I'm really excited to, simply because once you have a bit of facility, then suddenly the experiments will always be the number one thing determining what's really happening for me. Mm-hmm. But the theory is more interesting to me, right? I only do the experiments because then I can plot the data and see, and say, so what's really happening there? How what's the meaning of what's happening? And then the theory explains it. And so, but it's going to save a lot of time being able to just look ahead of time and say, oh, smart experiments to do are this and this and this, because that's where, if you put a coil here on the antenna, it looks like it should make a difference, you know. Mm-hmm. So very excited for this. Anyway, so I just wanted to put that in there because I'm excited for that.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So
okay, future plans.
Future plans, yes.
Okay, would you like to start? Or do you want me to, since you just...
Well, the first thing that's going to come up, if we end up at Pilot, tomorrow,
yes,
we'll get to check out that bolt and tighten it. Not a big deal, but it's kind of a fun thing. And then next week,
Tuesday,
cataract surgery.
I'm just like, I don't really want to be awake for it.
Oh, you won't. You'll be talking, like, you'll be conscious, but really,
they'll be like, shh.
So is that... It's some kind of a volume derivative they'll use, or something.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't make me talk a lot.
I just thought, I mean, it sends shivers to look at those videos, but it's fascinating at the same time.
Oh, it is incredible. Yeah. I had to stop watching. I tried to look at the cataract surgery. I love surgery. I think it's the most fascinating thing. Yeah. Just to see someone, you know, be able to help a person or an animal in that way, and to see the animal and person up moving afterwards, that's just really exciting. And the cataract surgery is done with microscopes. They don't even do any incisions. It's all like these micro, you know, cuts and things, and it is just fascinating to me.
I like to see how the laser splits the eye into like six.
Yeah, and so that so then they can go in and just pluck little pieces of the lens out before they pop in the new lens, and the lens is made to unfold.
Yeah,
and the whole technology behind it is too cool, and hopefully everything's aligned that everything works perfectly. But yeah, neat stuff. My future plan is cataract surgery. But if I can read afterwards, which I'm not sure how my reading will work, but to get into my GM project and start to think about that and first steps for that, really. And I'm going to be part of a Read to Me program this summer, which I haven't had a chance to tell you about. So I'm going to work for an hour, like maybe a few times through the summer, five times, and I'll be taking my maker space over. It's just to do the makey for a half hour with kids.
Oh, I want to get back to makey.
Yeah, so you could come. Basically, we're going into neighborhoods. It's a Read to Me program, kind of exciting. It is exciting. What they do is they go to neighborhoods, they read books, but then they leave the books that they read with the kids. Very nice. And I hope that all will work well. We'll be working outside, so there's a lot of concern on the person who runs the Read to Me program that the computers will work. But Tony thinks that he has is a person who's going to get me Wi-Fi.
Wow! Yeah. I just noticed the time.
So, and I'm going to stop knowing the time.
So where's our guidebook page?
It is time to go to the wrap-up.
Okay. Well, this has to change.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So, thank you for listening to the Island Creative Time Podcast. Or we'll have a short one called Island CT.
Yeah, we will.
Island Creative Time.
Yeah, and make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.